Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Berger. May it please the court, Peter Laddick, on behalf of appellant Cal-Maine Foods, Incorporated. This is the time set for oral argument on Cal-Maine's appeal of the Court of Chancery's order granting plaintiff's request for an award of attorney's fees and expenses after Cal-Maine abandoned a proposed reverse split of its common stock for the purpose of going private. There are two issues before the court on this appeal, one factual and one legal. The factual issue is whether Cal-Maine rebutted the presumption of causation created when Cal-Maine abandoned its reverse split after the plaintiffs filed this litigation. And the second legal issue is, which the court need only address if the court concludes that the presumption has not been rebutted, is whether under quantum merit principles it is appropriate to award a substantial success premium to plaintiffs, and if so, what factors are used to determine the reasonableness of that success premium. Now, with respect to the factual issue, as framed in Cal-Maine's brief, the issue is whether the Vice Chancellor applied the correct presumption in this case. And as the court is well aware, when a corporation abandons a transaction after a meritorious claim is filed, a rebuttable presumption is created that there was a causal connection between the initiation of the suit and any later benefit to the stockholders. Now, one of the bases for this presumption is that defendants who abandon a transaction apparently have concluded that they would rather walk away from the challenged transaction than subject their conduct to the scrutiny of the court and themselves to the risk of liability. And this concept is important here because the Vice Chancellor focused his factual inquiry on what happened in August when this transaction was originally approved by the special committee and the executive committee and then the full board. And he focused less on what Cal-Maine was facing at the end of October and the beginning of November, which is when Cal-Maine determined to abandon the transaction. And by focusing his inquiry on what happened in August, the Vice Chancellor required Cal-Maine to rebut an inference or a presumption that Cal-Maine had and its directors had breached their fiduciary duties when they originally approved the transaction in August in order to meet the factual standard necessary to rebut the presumption of causation.
Well, how do you respond to the quote on page 18 of the answering brief where your opponents quote the Chancellor as saying, again, I want to emphasize, I'm not saying anyone acted in bad faith or did anything wrong. I've got a presumption of causation here. And they cite that statement for the proposition that he knew exactly what the legal standard was and what the facts he was focusing on.
Well, I understand he said that, but if you look at the comments throughout the brief, or excuse me, throughout the transcript of the oral argument, Cal-Maine respectfully submits that the Vice Chancellor, even though he said, I'm not saying anything, anybody did anything wrong, he in fact was focusing on whether Mr. Adams and the rest of the directors did something wrong. The Vice Chancellor relied on the egg industry predictions to try to rebut or challenge Mr. Adams' affidavit that said that he didn't know that there was an impending upswing in the egg industry. There were comments throughout the transcript that say Mr. Adams knew what was going on when he proposed the transaction in July, and then they ultimately approved it in August. And he criticized the manner in which the transaction was approved in August. I believe he used the word hastily put together. And we submit that those comments really tell the story about what the Vice Chancellor was focusing on, notwithstanding the fact that he later tried to take those back by saying, well, I'm not saying anybody did anything wrong here.
Well, what's difficult in any case where you have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight is the allegations in the trial court seem to have been that the valuation was too low because the projections had been misread. And then as things move forward into the fall, even in October, some of the offers from your clients were substantially low based on where things went. And so the response from your opponents is, we were right. And hindsight, 2020 hindsight, shows we were right that you didn't foresee the upswing. Now, I mean, why, and their contention is that's really what the vice chancellor was saying, that the contention was you hadn't predicted things correctly. History confirmed that, and as a result, there was this causal connection.
Well, I respond to that by saying a lot of what happened back in August really shouldn't be relevant to the inquiry here for the causal connection, because when the board determined to abandon the transaction in October, or actually November, it was facing a very different scenario than what it was facing in August. It has a completely different scenario. The deal originally was $2. The deal was originally $7.35 to be paid cash in lieu of fractional shares. The stock at the end of October is trading in the high nines. And so the focus should be, what did Calamain know when it decided to abandon the transaction? Because regardless of whatever flaws may have existed in the first instance in August, the fact is that the original transaction that they had proposed was simply no longer viable. And it was no longer viable because the market outpriced it.
Is that the case, or could one infer from the facts in the record that it was no longer viable because it couldn't proceed at the pace that they originally intended, and that one of the reasons it couldn't was because the litigation highlighted problems with the valuation, which were reaffirmed by the SEC in its review, and the delay in getting the deal done, partly attributable to the litigation, was the reason that the volatility of the market price could come into play months later?
Okay, well, with respect to the market price, the market didn't react in an upward fashion because of anything that was done in the litigation.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. Okay. What I'm suggesting to you is it possible to read from the record, and is it arguably a part of the vice chancellor's analysis that had the parties who proposed this transaction been able to bring it to fruition quickly, with knowledge that it was a volatile market and that the probability was the prices would rise and therefore the price of the product and therefore the prices of the stock would rise, if they could get the deal done quickly without interference, they could go private before everyone became aware of this upswing in the market. But they weren't able to do so, in part because the litigation was an inhibiting obstacle. Is that a fair reading or not?
Well, I don't think so, because the only factor that delayed the consummation of the transaction was the SEC review. Now, the vice chancellor concluded that the litigation was a substantial part of why the SEC decided to conduct a full review. And frankly, I don't think that is a logical conclusion here for two reasons. One, there is no presumption that the SEC is doing anything in response to what is done in litigation in state courts.
And you minimize the fact that the SEC asked some of the same questions that were raised in the complaint, but that is an acknowledged fact in the record, isn't it, that the SEC raised some of the same similar questions in its list of 110 questions?
That is true, and we don't deny that some of the comments in the comment letter are similar to the allegations in the complaint, but there are, if there were 110 comments in the comment letter, at most 15 can be attributed to the allegations in the complaint.
Well, do you analyze that for the substance? What's the relative substance of those 15 compared to the other 85?
Well, I just don't think it's logical to assume that the SEC would have foregone the other 85 comments had the plaintiffs not raised, regardless of their substance, if the plaintiffs had not raised these allegations in the complaint. I mean, it was obvious that the SEC had a lot of questions about the proxy statement and a lot of questions about what the company was attempting to do in this case. And even though those allegations are contained within the comment letter, I just don't think it's reasonable to conclude that the SEC would have said, well, forget about it. We're going to forget our other 85 problems that we have with this deal because if the plaintiffs had not raised these allegations in the complaint. And so even, and that is regardless of the substance of the rest of the 85, because there are so many of them. I just don't think that it's reasonable to conclude that they would have foregone them. So, now the plaintiffs have argued that August is relevant because they've got these egg industry, this egg industry data that says Mr. Adams should have known that everything was going on the upswing. But that's not relevant because, and the reason is because in October, at the end of October and in the beginning of November, Cal-Maine was not faced with the choice of we'll go try to do our $7.35 deal or we won't do that deal at all. Because Cal-Maine knew that its $7.35 deal was not on the table. And so it knew that whatever it did to get to the $7.35 deal wasn't going to be subjected to judicial scrutiny because events had overtaken it and they needed to do something else. So they had a choice. They could do a revised deal or they could do no deal at all. And they tried to do a revised deal. The special committee and the executive committee got together and they were able to reach a proposed price that was not set in stone because they wanted to get what the plaintiff's input and what the plaintiffs thought about it. And to give you an idea of the volatility of the stock during this time period, although it had traded below the deal value from August 18th when the deal was announced up until, I believe, October 7th when the revised earnings were announced, or new earnings were announced, and it started to tick upwards. On the day in which the special committee and executive committee met to discuss a revised deal, when they went into the meeting, the price was trading in the high eights or low nines. When they got out of the meeting, it was almost 10. And this was a meeting that lasted a couple hours. So this is an indication of the volatility of the stock. Now, at the record below, there's a lot of back and forth over who said what to whom and when about whether the special committee's counsel talked to the plaintiffs and what the plaintiffs said back. And the court doesn't really need to figure that out because...
Well, the record shows people were leaving voice messages for each other and there was some confusion about whether they were received. But tell us why you say there's no causal connection to anything in the litigation when the litigation appears to have said you're not reading where the market's going correctly. And in fact, during the time of negotiations, it turns out the market was going up. And then these settlement offers keep getting rejected. Why doesn't the litigation and the concerns in the litigation have something to do with the reassessment of the proper price by your client?
Well, the reassessment of the proper price by the client came only after the market made the price untenable, the original price untenable. Now, there wasn't anything in the litigation that caused that. It was the earnings release at the beginning of October that caused the price to go upwards. And it was the realization that the original deal was no longer tenable. The stockholders would never go for it, and that is what caused the company to reassess the original deal and try to do something else. Now, the facts are a little murky on when the settlement did or did not get rejected. We admit that the plaintiffs never said yes to a price, and. I think the record is certainly clear on that. But the deal was underwater by approximately 27% now. The financial advisor to the special committee had told the special committee that it was uncomfortable and then eventually said we cannot issue or will not issue a fairness opinion because of the volatility of the stock price here. And the company concluded, and this is Mr. Adams' affidavit, that to revise the deal further upward beyond what they had originally discussed in the $9 range would have been too expensive for the company to go through with. And so it is those factors that caused the company to reach its conclusion that this deal is no longer viable. And I guess to respond more eloquently to your question, Justice Holland, I think if you look back at this deal and the way it transpired, it is a perfectly reasonable assumption that all of these events that occurred from August through the beginning of November would have occurred in the absence of the litigation. Because the litigation wasn't necessary to make the stock price go up. And I don't think it's a reasonable conclusion to make that the SEC would have put a hold on this deal in the absence of the litigation. They had plenty of comments anyway. And the plaintiff's own brief below says that it was folly for Cal-Maine to think that the going private transaction would have flown through SEC review like Cal-Maine originally was hoping that it would. And so if the SEC is going to do its review anyway and put a delay on this action, and that's going to allow the revised earnings to come out, and that's going to allow the market price to swing upward, Cal-Maine's in the same spot at the end of November, or excuse me, end of October and beginning of November as it is, as it would have been in the absence of the litigation.
I don't think any of us missed the point that one could construe the facts that way, but the way they come to us is, I believe, having been found a certain way by the Vice Chancellor in the context of whether or not one is rebutted a presumption, what is our standard review? How do we handle it with the record that we have?
Well, I mean, it's a factual determination, and so the court has to determine whether the determination made by the Vice Chancellor was the product of a logical and orderly deductive process. And I think that we have pointed out here in our brief that it was not the product of a logical and orderly deductive process, because I don't think that the conclusion about the SEC, the litigation's effect on the SEC, is sustainable. And I don't think that the... I don't think that if you look at it, you can say that everything would have happened in the absence of the litigation, that that there is a causal connection here. If it's all going to happen anyway, why did the plaintiffs get a benefit for saying, well, we caused this simply by the fact that they filed a lawsuit?
You're in your rebuttal, Tom.
Yes, I am.
I just wanted you to comment briefly on what's alluded to in the briefs as the policy argument,
yes,
where the Vice Chancellor said that he notes that if the settlement had been accepted, then the plaintiffs would have been entitled to a fee. But since the settlement was never consummated and the deal was abandoned, you're suggesting they don't get a fee. What, if anything, about that policy consideration should we address?
Well, I think you should address the fact that it shifts too much of the risk away from the plaintiffs in conducting litigation, because if plaintiffs know when they file a lawsuit that they can go into negotiations and continue to reject settlement offers with the knowledge that even if they reject an offer, they're still going to get a fee, I think that changes the scenario between the plaintiffs and defendants in these kinds of cases. There has to be some risk on the plaintiff's side for them to conduct this litigation. And I'm not saying that it has to be a tremendous amount of risk, but there has to be some risk on their side. Otherwise, the defendants are in a position where the only way that they can get out of paying a fee is to actually litigate the case and win. And there has to be another set of circumstances where the defendants don't have to pay a fee.
Do you want to use that?
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Gary Trainer. I appear this morning on behalf of the appellees, who were the plaintiffs in the three class actions that were consolidated by the court below. At counsel table with me is Richard Donaldson of the firm of Montgomery, McCracken, Walker & Rhodes. he represented the plaintiffs in one of the actions that was consolidated. In both its briefs and again in its argument to the court today, Cal-Maine has argued points that were neither asserted by the plaintiffs nor adopted by the court below. This straw man tactic is no doubt inspired by the fact that Cal-Maine faces two very difficult and we would submit insurmountable obstacles. First, the awarding of fees is a discretionary matter, and Cal-Maine cannot point to an abuse of discretion by the Vice Chancellor. Second, court below relied upon a legal presumption in finding that there was a causal connection between plaintiff's lawsuit and Cal-Maine's termination of the going private transaction, and made several factual findings supported by the record that were adverse to Cal-Maine regarding their failed effort to rebut that presumption.
Mr. Trainer, let me ask you a hypothetical question about causal connection. Let's suppose that there was a different type of company. They were in the gold mining business, and the company has a value, and they're going to do a transaction like this, and a lawsuit is filed, just like your lawsuit, contending the value is too low, based on the way gold was trading or something. But then, after the suit's filed, they discover a huge deposit of gold that just changes the value of the company. I don't think anyone would argue that the change in the value of the company that was attributable to this newly discovered asset was caused by the litigation. And that seems to be the argument that your opponents are making, that certainly you filed a lawsuit, but that this upward swing in the market was something that was unrelated to anything you were doing. What is it that the lawsuit did that resulted in an increase in the price?
Nothing that the lawsuit did resulted in an increase in the price, and we have never claimed that it resulted in an increase in the price. We have stated repeatedly that the benefit that we caused was the things that flowed from the termination of the transaction, including the allowing the 2.2 million shares that would have been either cashed out in the reverse split or in the follow-up transaction to remain, for those shareholders to maintain their stake in the company and keep the company as a listed company. Once we show that benefit, it is incumbent upon us to show the value of the benefit, or traditional analysis of determining what an appropriate fee is would suggest that the court should analyze what is the value of the benefit. It is then that the court analyzes the subsequent rise in the stock price to determine how that benefit should be valued, not in a mathematical sort of way, but as one, to use Vice Chancellor Strine's words, as a modest way. The court, in fact, below looked at the most modest number put forth, the most conservative number, the very day the transaction was terminated. Also,
well, no, but before we get to computing the fee, continue elaborating on this causation, because what Mr. Donaldson is saying is the termination was caused by the market just outdistancing the transaction price. And how did, why is he wrong in that assertion? And how did the litigation do something that caused the termination that created a benefit?
Well, Mr. Ladig stated to the court that in late October, the price was in the high nines. The fact of the matter is, when the negotiations restarted, according to Cal-Maine, on or around October 10th, that is when the special committee approached Mr. Adams, who was negotiating on behalf of the company, and said, we need to rethink this. We have a lot, the special committee has a lot of concerns. The stock price was actually at $7.51 the date before that. It closed the day before. That is lower than the stock price was on the day before the board approved the initial transaction. there was no drastic increase in the stock price leading up to the renegotiation. What better evidence, and the Vice Chancellor seized upon this, what better evidence to show that the litigation did, in fact, have a causal effect on what the special committee was doing and what the board was doing. I would invite the court to look at a chart that we have submitted at page B131, where we track the stock price. And the court will see that from the time the original transaction was announced on August 18th through the reinitiation of negotiations, and even for some time thereafter, there was no market increase in the stock price. The only plausible explanation for the renewal of negotiations at that point in time was they had a viable lawsuit pending against them. In that regard, Vice Chancellor Strine found that even without a presumption, all these facts, including facts relating to what the company knew about egg prices, would lead him to find causation even in the absence of a presumption. So we, you know, they have to go much further than that. They have a presumption to rebut, and they clearly did not do that. Really, what Cowmaine attempts to do in his briefs is to suggest that something controversial was done by the court below. In fact, what the Vice Chancellor did was apply a very uncontroversial test for determining entitlement to a fee in a mootness context, and then he followed it by a rational exercise of his discretion in determining what the amount of that fee was. There are a number of compelling reasons supporting the Vice Chancellor's finding that the presumption was not rebutted. There was evidence showing that Cowmaine knew all along that egg prices would go up. I think, Justice Holland, you posited a very charitable view of the facts when you suggested that we predicted it right and they were caught by surprise. In fact, we submitted evidence below, and it's in our appendix, showing that they knew that egg prices were high in August. And everybody knew that annually egg prices go up at the end of the year. So the scenario we put before the Vice Chancellor was much closer to what Chief Justice Steele mentioned was, and what Vice Chancellor Strine seemed to at least give some credence to, was that they knew egg prices would go up, stock prices would go up. They wanted to buy this company back from the public shareholders as quickly as possible so they would have that value.
You mentioned in the beginning about straw man arguments, so let me try one of my own because it's troubling me from the record, and perhaps you can clear it up. Was this a deal where the majority shareholders had said that when the minority voted on going private, that they would vote their shares in the same percentage, which would suggest at least at some place in the record that there never could have been a going private transaction without the consent of a majority of the minority, who by then would have known that the price was out of whack with the price that was being offered at the time. Therefore, the deal could never have gotten done in a way that was adverse to the minority shareholders.
That was a point that was in controversy for this reason. Mr. Adams, one shareholder, said he would vote in proportion to the vote of the other shareholders. That, apparently, we only learned this after the case was mooted, and we learned that there was apparently a tentative agreement that never got consummated because apparently Houlihan would not opine on it, to include other shareholders voting in proportion. But as our complaint showed, when you took the company's ESOP, the employees who own shares, and considered them as individuals who would want to stay with the company under all circumstances, it really, we argued, was a locked-up vote. Now, that was, in fairness to Cowmaine.
Well, in fairness to any intelligent employee, they're going to stay when it goes from $7.35 to $44?
Oh, absolutely, at that point. But we said at the outset that the vote was indeed locked up, notwithstanding Mr. Adams, who clearly was the most significant shareholder, notwithstanding his statement or his undertaking to vote in proportion to the rest of the vote, was not a true minority, a majority of the minority vote.
So your understanding of the record reflects it's just Adams and not all the other shareholders?
That was our understanding going in, but then the transaction as modified but never consummated brought along additional individuals who were to vote in proportion.
You understand why I asked the question? If the issue is, did the litigation cause the transaction to be abandoned? If the facts show that, given the market conditions, the transaction would never have been consummated in any event because a majority of the minority would never have gone private on the dollars offered, knowing that the market price was rising dramatically by the fall.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and that is why it was even further a locked up, foregone conclusion that if they got to a vote, the ESOP people would, in our view, see that they were capturing, along with Mr. Adams and the defendants, the value
of the private entity.
Of the value of the shares previously held by the public shareholder.
Okay.
And for that reason, it would have.
So it's a false premise to assume that the majority of the minority would have voted the private transaction down in any event.
That's our position, yes. Further evidence was presented, as I stated already, that when the special committee reopened negotiations, the stock price was actually lower than it was when the deal was announced by the board. Additionally, there was no affidavit or evidence submitted to support Mr. Adams' self-serving, hearsay-written affidavit, especially on the point that regarding Houlihan Lokey and the fact that their failure to or unwillingness to offer a fairness opinion was not related to the litigation. In fact, there's evidence in the record to suggest that that assertion was entirely implausible because, as I stated, when the deal was initially announced, it represented a negative 3% premium. On the day that Houlihan Lokey expressed its initial unwillingness to bless the $9.05 deal, closing price from the day before would suggest what? A negative 3% premium. The amount of the premium was the same the first time when Houlihan Lokey said it was fair as it was when Houlihan Lokey said they can't opine. So there's plenty of evidence to support the finding that Calmaine fell very far short of rebutting the presumption.
And what are the implications for the future if offers of settlement are relevant to making determinations such as the ones in this case, since traditionally you make settlement offers without prejudice because they're not admissible as evidence? And the contention from Mr. Laddick is if you turn down an offer and you don't litigate, settlement's never reached, and it becomes moot, then you've foregone a fee even though you would otherwise get a fee if you settle.
Well, I don't think it's an impact that will trouble the court. I think what Vice Chancellor Strein was recognizing there was that if we had agreed to a price which we, in fact, said was unfair, the $9.05 price, we would have been able to claim a benefit of close to $4 million. It'd be like $3.8 million difference between the value of the public shares at 735 and 905, in which case we might have been able to secure a handsome fee award. But our clients, who were knowledgeable of the egg industry, recognized that $9.05 was not fair. Our expert, Dr. Puglisi, recognized that. We recognized that, and we stood by our position that it was unfair.
Well,
in fact, we were.
Well, it seems that one way to answer my question from your perspective would be that while offers of settlement are not generally admissible in litigation, this is a different type of litigation. And if, in fact, there have been a lot of complimentary things said about class action settlements in Delaware by the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts because we look at them carefully, then we would want to encourage plaintiff's lawyers to turn down low settlements. And if you're going to really encourage them and have them reject low settlement offers, they should at least be able to rely on them later on if the litigation becomes moot.
Well, I think I understand your question better now. You're sort of two issues mixed here. One is the admissibility of settlement discussions, which we did argue before Vice Chancellor Strong. He found that the settlement discussions were not offered for reasons such that they would be excludable under Rule 408, and CalMain has not appealed that. They were directly relevant to the fee application because CalMain was arguing that we were not on the company's mind. We were not on the special committee's mind, and that was belied by the fact that they called us and said, look, we're trying to get a modified deal, an improved deal. Will you buy into this price? In fact, we explicitly turned down a lower price earlier in October, and even when they came to $9.05, there was, as the court has noted, controversy over whether we explicitly rejected it or whether it was still in play, but everyone acknowledges that we didn't accept it. So the settlement negotiations were merely put before the court to, in fact, we were careful not to put initially specific numbers because we weren't trying to make the argument that we would have been entitled to, arguably entitled to a fee if they had done a new deal at $9.05. We were merely trying to bring to the court's attention that the contention that we were not in the mix was just, you know, divorced entirely from reality. Now, I don't know if that is responsive to Your Honor's question, but I hope it is.
Yes, thank you.
Finally, on the reasonableness of the fee, Mr. Laddick has really not confronted in his argument how the fee in this case was an abuse of discretion. As I noted, we did, once we showed the benefit, we tried to show the value of that benefit. Vice Chancellor Strine looked at the most conservative numbers that we put before him. It was really, everyone recognized what a boon the termination of the transaction was to the public shareholders. As of the date the transaction was terminated, the difference in the value of the public shares, notwithstanding what CalMain has argued that we really should just look at the 800,000 shares that would be cashed out in the reverse split, it was clear that there was a follow-up transaction where the remaining 1.4 million shares would be cashed out, or they would have to remain stockholders in a non-public company. 2 weeks after November 6th, the stock price was up to $19.34. That was before the fee award. That was a difference in value of almost $27 million. And at the end of December, the difference was $80 million. Indeed, Mr. Adams, who put forth the affidavit, sold a block of shares at near.
Well, that's all true, but the issue is to what is that attributable? And they say it's the market. You say, well, you may not be the sole cause, but you're a cause.
Well, again, Your Honor, that and we concede that we did not create the increase in stock price, but it is a manner to get a handle on the value of the benefit, not as a sort of common fund. We want a percentage of that, but it's to put the amount of the fee request in some perspective in relation to the benefit we can claim credit for, that is keeping the public shareholders from being cashed out at an unfair price. That's the point we'd like to make there. To sum up, we don't believe that CalMain has shown any abuse of discretion by the court below. The fee award was justified under the facts and the law. We would therefore ask the court to affirm the decision below. If there are no further questions, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Trainer.
I'd just like to briefly respond to something Mr. Trainer said in one of your Honor's questions. Mr. Adams, who owns approximately 60% of the outstanding shares of the company at the relevant time, was going to vote his shares in proportion. The rest of the executive officers had not made that commitment at the time of the original transaction. The ESOP, which is controlled by the day-to-day employees of the company, the non-executives, was simply going to vote however they thought. And I don't think it's economically rational to assume that a stock, an ESOP member is going to vote down a deal for $9, or accept the deal for $7.35 when the market price is $9.35. I just don't think that that's a rational conclusion that the plaintiffs can make, and I don't think that that's appropriate thing for, it's appropriate to assume that the ESOP is going to vote as a block in favor of the in favor of the transaction.
Thank you very much.
Please rise.
Thank you very much for your argument. Council will be in recess.